Drill sergeant's voice. Grow yelled, "Yo! Ollie Dinsmore, front and center!" Slowly the boy opened his eyes and looked at the two men crouched less than a foot away, but in a colder, cleaner world. "What?" he whispered. "Nothing, son," Grow said. "Go back to sleep." Grow turned to Ames. "Unbunch your panties, Private. He's fine."
"He's not. Just look at him."
Grow took Ames by the arm and helped him, not unkindly, to his feet. "No," he agreed in a low voice. "He's not even slightly okay, but he's alive and sleeping, and right now, that's the best we can ask for. He'll use up less oxygen that way. You go get yourself something to eat. Did you get any breakfast?" Ames shook his head. The thought of breakfast hadn't even crossed his mind.
"I won't stay in case he comes back round."
He paused, then plunged.
"I want to be here if he dies."
"He's not going to for a while," Grow said. He had no idea if this was true or not. "Get something out of the truck. Even if it's only a slice of bologna wrapped in a slice of bread. You look like shit, soldier." Ames jerked his head toward the sleeping boy on charred ground with his mouth and nose cocked to the dome. His face was streaked with filth, and they could barely see the rise and fall of his chest.
"How long do you think he's got, Sarge?"
Grow shook his head. "Probably not long. Someone in the group on the other side already died this morning, and several of the others aren't doing well. And it's better over there, cleaner. You have to prepare yourself." Ames felt close to tears.
"Kid lost his whole family."
"Go get yourself something to eat. I'll watch until you come back."
"But after that, I can stay?"
"The kid wants you, Private. The kid gets you. You can stay until the end." Grow watched Ames double time to the table near the helicopter where some food was laid out. Out here it was 10 o'clock on a pretty late fall morning. The sun was shining and melting off the last of a heavy frost. But only a few feet away there was a bubble world of perpetual twilight, a world where the air was unbreathable and time had ceased to have any meaning. Grow remembered a pond in the local park where he'd grown up, Wilton, Connecticut, that had been. There had been golden carp in the pond, big old things. The kids used to feed them. Until one day when one of the groundskeepers had an accident with some fertilizer, that was. Goodbye, fishies. All 10 or a dozen of them floating dead on the surface. Looking at the dirty, sleeping boy on the other side of the dome, it was impossible not to think of those carp. Only a boy was not a fish. Ames came back, eating something he obviously didn't want. Not much of a soldier, in Grow's opinion, but a good kid with a good heart. Private Ames sat down. Sergeant Grow sat with him. Around noon, they got a report from the north side of the dome that another of the survivors over there had died. A little boy named Aiden Appleton. Another kid. Grow believed he might have met his mother the day before. He hoped he was wrong about that, but didn't think he was.
"Who did it?" Ames asked him. "Who wound this shit up, Sergeant? Why?"
Grow shook his head. "No idea."
"Makes no sense," Ames cried.
Beyond them, Ollie stirred, lost his air, and moved his sleeping face once more to the scant breeze seeping through the barrier. "Don't wake him up," Grow said, thinking, "If he goes in his sleep, it'll be better for all of us." 13. By 2 o'clock, all of the exiles were coughing except, incredible but true, Sam Verdreau, who seemed to be thriving in the bad air, and little Walter Bushy, who did nothing but sleep and suck the occasional ration of milk or juice. Barbie sat against the dome with his arm around Julia. Not far away, Thurston Marshall sat beside the covered corpse of little Aiden Appleton, who had died with terrifying suddenness. Thurst, now coughing steadily, was holding Alice on his lap. She had cried herself to sleep. 20 feet further on, Rusty was huddled with his wife and girls, who had also cried themselves to sleep. Rusty had taken Audrey's body to the ambulance, so the girls wouldn't have to look at it. He held his breath throughout. Even 15 yards inland from the dome, the air became choking, deadly. Once he got his wind back, he supposed he should do the same with the little boy. Audrey would be good company for him. She'd always liked kids. Joe McClatchy plopped down beside Barbie. Now he really did look like a scarecrow.
His pale face was dotted with acne and there were circles of bruised-looking purple flesh under his eyes.
My mom's sleeping, Joe said. Julia too, Barbie said, so keep your voice down. Julia opened one eye.
Not sleeping, she said, and promptly closed the eye again.
She coughed still, then coughed some more.
Benny's really sick, Joe said. He's running a fever, like the little boy did before he died.
He hesitated.
My mom's pretty warm, too. Maybe it's only because it's so hot in here, but I don't think that's it.
What if she dies? What if we all do?
We won't, Barbie said.
They'll figure something out. Joe shook his head.
They won't, and you know it, because they're outside. Nobody outside can help us.
He looked over the blackened wasteland where there had been a town the day before and laughed. A hoarse croaking sound that was worse because there was actually some amusement in it.
Chester's Mill has been a town since 1803. We learned that in school. Over 200 years. And a week to wipe it off the face of the earth. One fucking week is all it took. How about that, Colonel Barbara?
Barbie couldn't think of a thing to say. Joe covered his mouth, coughed. Behind them, the fans roared and roared.
I'm a smart kid, you know that. I mean, I'm not bragging, but I'm smart.
Barbie thought of the video feed the kid had set up near the site of the missile strike.
No argument, Joe. In a Spielberg movie, it's the smart kid who'd come up with the last-minute solution, isn't that right?
Barbie felt Julia stir again. Both eyes were open now, and she was regarding Joe gravely. Tears were trickling down the boy's cheeks.
Some Spielberg kid I turned out to be. If we were in Jurassic Park, the dinosaurs would eat us for sure.
If only they'd get tired, Julia said dreamily.
Huh?
Joe blinked at her.
The leatherhead children. Kids are supposed to get tired of their games and go on to something else, or...
She coughed hard.
Or their parents call them home for dinner.
Maybe they don't eat, Joe said gloomily. Maybe they don't have parents either.
Or maybe time is different for them, Barbie said. In their world, maybe they only just sat down around their version of the box. For them, the game might only be starting. We don't even know for sure they're children. Piper Libby joined them. She was flushed and her hair was sticking to her cheeks.
They're kids, she said.
How do you know? Barbie asked.
I just do.
She smiled.
They're the God I stopped believing in about 3 years ago. God turned out to be a bunch of bad little kids playing Interstellar Xbox. Isn't that funny?
Her smile widened and then she burst into tears. Julia was looking toward the box with its flashing purple light. Her face was thoughtful and a little dreamy. 14. It's Saturday night in Chester's Mill. That's the night the Eastern Star ladies used to meet. And after the meeting, they'd often go to Henrietta Clavert's house and drink wine and break out their best dirty jokes. It's the night when Peter Randolph and his buddies used to play poker and also break out their best dirty jokes. The night when Stuart and Fern Bowie often went to Lewiston to rent a couple of whores at a pussy parlor on Lower Lisbon Street. The night when the Reverend Lester Coggins used to hold teen prayer meetings in the parsonage hall at Holy Redeemer, and Piper Libby used to host teen dances in the basement of the Congo Church. The night when dippers used to roar until one, and around 12:30 the crowd would begin chanting drunkenly for their anthem, Dirty Water, a song all bands from Boston know well. The night when Howie and Brenda Perkins used to walk hand in hand on the town common, saying hello to the other couples they knew. The night when Alden Dinsmore, his wife, Shelley, and their two sons had been known to play catch by the light of a full moon. In Chester's Mill, as in most small towns where they all support the team, Saturday nights were usually the best nights, made for dancing and fucking and dreaming. Not this one. This one is black and seemingly endless. The wind has died. The poisoned air hangs hot and still. Out where Route 119 used to be until the furnace heat boiled it away, Ollie Dinsmore lies with his face pressed to his slot in the slag, still holding stubbornly onto life, and only a foot and a half away, Private Clint Ames continues his patient watch. Some bright boy wanted to shine a spotlight on the kid. Ames,
supported by Sergeant Groh, not such an ogre after all, managed to keep it from happening, arguing that shining spotlights on sleeping people was what you did to terrorists, not teenage kids who would probably be dead before the sun rose. But Ames has a flashlight, and every now and then he shines it on the kid, making sure that he's still breathing. He is, but each time Ames uses the flashlight again, he expects it to show him that those shallow respirations have stopped. Part of him has actually started to hope for that. Part of him has started to accept the truth. No matter how resourceful Ollie Dinsmore has been or how heroically he's struggled, he has no future. Watching him fight on is terrible. Not long before midnight, Private Ames falls asleep himself, sitting up, with the flashlight clutched loosely in one hand. "Sleepest thou?" Jesus is said to have inquired of Peter. "Couldst thou not watch 1 hour?" To which Chef Bushy might have added, "Book of Matthew, Sanders." At just past 1 o'clock, Rose Twitchell shakes Barbie awake.
"Thurston Marshall is dead," she says. "Rusty and my brother are putting the body under the ambulance, so the little girl won't be too upset when she wakes up." Then she adds, "If she wakes up. Alice is sick, too." "We're all sick now," Julia says. "Oh, except Sam and that dopey little baby."
Rusty and Twitch hurry back from the huddle of vehicles, collapse in front of one of the fans, and begin breathing in large, whooping gasps. Twitch starts coughing, and Rusty shoves him even closer to the air so hard that Twitch's forehead strikes the dome. They all hear the bonk. Rose has not quite finished her inventory.
"Benny Drake's bad, too."
She lowers her voice to a whisper.
"Ginny says he may not last until sunup. If only there was something we could do."
Barbie doesn't reply. Neither does Julia, who is once more looking in the direction of a box which, although less than 50 square inches in area and not even an inch thick, cannot be budged. Her eyes are distant, speculative. A reddish moon finally clears the accumulated filth on the eastern wall of the dome and shines down its bloody light. This is the end of October, and in Chester's Mill, October is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire. There are no lilacs in this dead land. No lilacs, no trees, no grass. The moon looks down on ruination and little else.
15. Big Jim awoke in the dark, grabbing at his chest. His heart was misfiring again. He pounded at it. Then the alarm on the generator went off as the current tank of propane reached the danger point. "Feed me. Feed me." Big Jim jumped and cried out. His poor, tortured heart was lurching, missing, skipping, then running to catch up with itself. He felt like an old car with a bad carburetor. The kind of rattle trap you might take in trade, but would never sell. The kind that was good for nothing but the junk heap. He gasped and pounded. This was as bad as the one that had sent him to the hospital. Maybe even worse. The sound of some huge, gruesome insect. A cicada, maybe. Here in the dark with him. Who knew what might have crept in here while he was sleeping? Big Jim fumbled for the flashlight. With the other hand, he alternately pounded and rubbed, telling his heart to settle down, not to be such a cotton-picking baby. He hadn't gone through all of this just to die in the dark. He found the flashlight, struggled to his feet, and stumbled over the body of his late aide-de-camp. He cried out again and went to his knees. The flashlight didn't break, but went rolling away from him, casting a moving spotlight on the lowest left-hand shelf, which was stacked with boxes of spaghetti and cans of tomato paste. Big Jim crawled after it. As he did, Carter Thibodeau's open eyes moved. "Carter?" Sweat was running down Big Jim's face. His cheeks felt coated with some light, stinking grease. He could feel his shirt sticking to him. His heart took another of those looping larrups, and then, for a wonder, settled into its normal rhythm again. Well, no, not exactly. But at least into something more like a normal rhythm. "Carter? Son? Are you alive?" "Ridiculous, of course. Big Jim had gutted him like a fish on a riverbank, then shot him in the back of the head. He was as dead as Adolf Hitler. Yet he could have sworn, well, almost sworn, that the boy's eyes... He fought back the idea that Carter was going to reach out and seize him by the throat, telling himself it was normal to feel a little bit terrified. Nervous. Because the boy had nearly killed him, after all, and still expecting Carter to sit up and draw him forward and bury hungry teeth in his throat. Big Jim pressed his fingers under Carter's jaw. The blood-sticky flesh was cold and no pulse moved there. Of course not. The kid was dead, had been dead for 12 hours or more. "You're eating dinner with your savior, son," Big Jim whispered. "Roast beef and mashed. Apple cobbler for dessert." This made him feel better. He crawled after the flashlight, and when he thought he heard something move behind him, the whisper of a hand, perhaps, slipping across the concrete floor, blindly questing, he didn't look back. He had to feed the generator. Had to silence the... While he was pulling one of the 4 remaining tanks out of the storage cubby, his heart went into arrhythmia again. He sat beside the open trap door, gasping and trying to cough his heart back into a regular rhythm, and praying, unaware that his prayer was basically a series of demands and rationalizations. Make it stop. None of it was my fault. Get me out of here. I did the best I could. Put everything back the way it was. I was let down by incompetence. Heal my heart. For Jesus' sake, amen, he said. But the sound of the words chilled rather than comforted. They were like bones rattling in a tomb. By the time his heart had settled a little, the hoarse, cicada cry of the alarm had stilled. The current tank had run dry. Save for the glow of the flashlight, it was now as dark in the fallout shelter's second room as in the first. The remaining emergency light in here had flickered its last 7 hours ago. Struggling to remove the empty tank and get the fresh one onto the platform beside the generator, Big Jim had a faint memory of stamping "no action" on a shelter maintenance requisition that had come across his desk a year or two ago. That requisition had probably included the price of fresh batteries for the emergency lights, but he couldn't blame himself. There was only so much money in a town budget, and people always had their hands out. Feed me, feed me. Al Timmons should have done it on his own initiative, he told himself. For God's sake, is a little initiative too much to ask? Isn't that part of what we pay the maintenance staff for? He could have gone to that frog burpee and asked for them as a donation, for heaven's sake. That's what I would have done. He connected the tank to the generator. Then his heart stuttered again. His hand jerked, and he knocked the flashlight into the storage bin, where it clanged against one of the remaining tanks. The lens shattered, and he was left once more in total darkness. No! He screamed. No, goddamn it, no! But from God, there was no answer. The quiet and the dark pressed in on him as his overstrained heart choked and struggled. Traitorous thing. Never mind, there'll be another flashlight in the other room. Matches, too. I'll just have to find them. If Carter had stockpiled them to begin with, I could go right to them. It was true. He had overestimated that boy. He had thought the kid was a comer, but in the end he had turned out to be a goer. Big Jim laughed, then made himself stop. The sound in such total darkness was a little spooky. Never mind. Start the generator. Yes. Right. The generator was job one. He could double-check the connection once it was running and the air purifier was creeping away again. By then he'd have another flashlight, maybe even a Coleman lantern. Plenty of light for the next tank switchover. That's the ticket, he said. If you want something done right in this world, you have to do it yourself. Just ask Coggins. Just ask the Perkins Rhymes with Witch. They know. He laughed some more. He couldn't help it, because it really was rich. They found out. You don't tease a big dog if you only have a little stick. No, sir. No, siree. He felt around for the starter button, found it, pushed it. Nothing happened. Suddenly the air in the room seemed thicker than ever. I pushed the wrong button, that's all. Knowing better but believing it because some things have to be believed. He blew on his fingers like a crapshooter hoping to heat up a cold pair of dice.
Then he felt around until his fingers found the button. God, he said, this is your servant, James Rennie. Please let this darned old thing start. I ask it in the name of your son, Jesus Christ. He pushed the starter button. Nothing. He sat in the dark with his feet dangling in the storage compartment, trying to push back the panic that wanted to descend and eat him raw. He had to think. It was the only way to survive. But it was hard. When you were in the dark, when your heart was threatening full revolt at any second, thinking was hard. And the worst of it? Everything he'd done and everything he'd worked for during the last 30 years of his life seemed unreal. Like the way people looked on the other side of the dome. They walked, they talked, they drove cars, they even flew in airplanes and helicopters. But none of it mattered. Not under the dome. Get hold of yourself. If God won't help you, help yourself. Okay. The first thing was light. Even a book of matches would do. There had to be something on one of the shelves in the other room. He would just feel along, very slowly, very methodically, until he found it. And then he would find batteries for the cotton-picking starter motor. There were batteries, of that he was sure, because he needed the generator. Without the generator, he would die. Suppose you do get it started again, what happens when the propane runs out? Ah, but something would intervene. He wasn't meant to die down here. Roast beef with Jesus? He'd pass on that meal, actually. If he couldn't sit at the head of the table, he'd just as soon skip the whole thing. That made him laugh again. He made his way very slowly and carefully back to the door leading into the main room. He held his hands out in front of him like a blind man. After 7 steps, they touched the wall. He moved to the right, trailing his fingertips over the wood, and, ah, emptiness. The doorway. Good. He shuffled through it, moving more confidently now in spite of the blackness. He remembered the layout of this room perfectly. Shelves to either side, couch dead ahead. He tripped over the goddamn cotton-picking kid again and went sprawling. He hit his forehead on the floor and screamed, more in surprise and outrage than in pain, because there was a carpet to pad the blow. But, oh, God, there was a dead hand between his legs. It seemed to be clutching at his balls. Big Jim got to his knees, crawled forward, and hit his head again, this time on the couch. He let out another yell, then crawled up onto it, pulling his legs after him quickly, the way a man might pull his legs from water he's just realized is infested with sharks. He lay there trembling, telling himself to calm down. He had to calm down, or he really would have a heart attack. When you feel his arrhythmias, you need to center yourself and take long, deep breaths, the hippie doctor had told him. At the time, Big Jim had considered this New Age bullshit, but now there was nothing else. He didn't have his verapamil, so he'd have to try it. And it seemed to work. After 20 deep breaths and long, slow exhales, he could feel his heart settling. The coppery taste was leaving his mouth. Unfortunately, a weight seemed to be settling on his chest. Pain was creeping down his left arm. He knew these were heart attack symptoms, but he thought indigestion from all the sardines he'd eaten was just as likely, more likely. The long, slow breaths were taking care of his heart just fine, but he would still get it looked at when he was out of this mess, maybe even give in and get that bypass surgery. The heat was the problem. The heat and the thick air. He had to find that flashlight and get the Jenny going again, just 1 more minute, or maybe 2. Someone was breathing in here. Yes, of course, I'm breathing in here. And yet, he was quite sure he heard someone else. More than just one someone. It seemed to him that there were several people in here with him. And he thought he knew who they were. That's ridiculous. Yes, but one of the breathers was behind the couch. One was lurking in the corner. And one was standing not 3 feet in front of him. No, stop it. Brenda Perkins behind the couch, Lester Coggins in the corner, his jaw unhinged and hanging, and standing dead ahead. No, Big Jim said, that's crap, that's bullshit. He closed his eyes and tried to concentrate on taking those long, slow breaths. It sure smells good in here, Dad. Junior droned from in front of him. It smells like the pantry. And my girlfriend's. Big Jim shrieked. Help me up, bro, Carter said from where he lay on the floor.
He cut me up pretty bad. Shot me, too.
Stop it, Big Jim whispered. I don't hear any of that, so just stop it. I'm counting breaths. I'm settling my heart.
I still have the papers, Brenda Perkins said, and lots of copies. Soon they'll be tacked to every telephone pole in town, the way Julia tacked up the last issue of her newspaper. Be sure your sin will find you out. Numbers, chapter 32.
You're not there.
But then, something, it felt like a finger, kissed its way down his cheek.
Big Jim shrieked again. The fallout shelter was full of dead people who were nevertheless breathing the increasingly foul air, and they were moving in. Even in the dark, he could see their pale faces. He could see his dead son's eyes.
Big Jim bolted up from the couch, flailing at the black air with his fists. Get away! All of you, get away from me!
He charged for the stairs and tripped over the bottom one. This time there was no carpet to cushion the blow. Blood began to drip into his eyes. A dead hand caressed the back of his neck.
You killed me, Lester Coggins said. But with his broken jaw, it came out, ooh-ee.
Big Jim ran up the stairs and hit the door at the top with all his considerable weight. It squalled open, pushing charred lumber and fallen bricks in front of it. It went just far enough for him to squeeze through.
No, he barked. No, don't touch me. None of you, touch me.
It was almost as dark in the ruins of the town hall conference room as in the shelter, but with one big difference. The air was worthless. Big Jim realized this when he pulled in his third breath. His heart, tortured beyond endurance by this final outrage, once more rose into his throat. This time, it stuck there. Big Jim suddenly felt as if he were being crushed from throat to navel by a terrible weight, a long burlap sack filled with stones. He struggled back to the door like a man moving through mud. He tried to squeeze through the gap, but this time he stuck fast. A terrible sound began to emerge from his gaping mouth and closing throat, and the sound was, ah, feed me, feed me, feed me. He flailed once again, then once more, a hand reaching out, grasping for some final rescue. It was caressed from the other side.
Daddy, a voice crooned.
16. Someone shook Barbie awake just before dawn on Sunday morning. He came to reluctantly, coughing, turning instinctively to the dome and the fans beyond. When the coughing finally eased, he looked to see who had awakened him. It was Julia. Her hair hung lankly, and her cheeks were blooming with fever, but her eyes were clear. She said,
Benny Drake died an hour ago.
Oh, Julia, Jesus, I'm sorry. His voice was cracked and hoarse, not his own voice at all.
I have to get to the box that's making the dome, she said. How do I get to the box?
Barbie shook his head.
It's impossible. Even if you could do something to it, it's on the ridge almost half a mile from here. We can't even go to the vans without holding our breaths, and they're only 50 feet away.
There's a way, someone said. They looked around and saw Sloppy Sam Verdreau. He was smoking the last of his cigarettes and looking at them with sober eyes. He was sober, entirely sober, for the first time in 8 years. He repeated, There's a way. I could show you. Wear it home, it'll look like a dress.
1.
It was 7:30 a.m. They had all gathered round, even the late Benny Drake's wretched, red-eyed mother. Alva had her arm around Alice Appleton's shoulders. All that little girl's former sass and spunk was gone now, and as she breathed, rails rattled in her narrow chest. When Sam finished what he had to say, there was a moment of silence, except, of course, for the omnipresent roar of the fans. Then Rusty said,
It's crazy. You'll die.
If we stay here, will we live? Barbie asked.
Why would you even try to do such a thing? Linda asked. Even if Sam's idea works and you make it.
Oh, I think it'll work, Romy said.
Sure it will, Sam said. Guy named Peter Bergeron told me not long after the big Bar Harbor fire back in 47. Pete was a lot of things, but never a liar.
Even if it does, Linda said, why? because there's one thing we haven't tried, Julia said.
Now that her mind was made up and Barbie had said he would go with her, she was composed.
We haven't tried begging.
You're crazy, Jules, Tony Gay said. Do you think they'll even hear or listen if they do?
Julia turned her grave face to Rusty. That time your friend George Lathrop was burning ants alive with his magnifying glass, did you hear them beg?
Ants can't beg, Julia.
You said it occurred to me that ants also have their little lives. Why did it occur to you?
Because... He trailed off, then shrugged.
Maybe you did hear them, Lissa Jameson said.
With all due respect, that's bullshit, Pete Freeman said. Ants are ants, they can't beg.
But people can, Julia said. And do we not also have our little lives?
To this no one replied.
What else is there to try?
From behind them, Colonel Cox spoke up. They had all but forgotten him. The outside world and its denizens seemed irrelevant now.
I'd try it. In your shoes. Don't quote me, but... Yes, I would. Barbie?
I've already agreed, Barbie said. She's right. There's nothing else. Two.
Let's see them sacks, Sam said.
Linda handed over three green hefty bags. In two of them, she had packed clothes for herself and Rusty and a few books for the girls. The shirts, pants, socks, and underwear now lay carelessly discarded behind the little group of survivors. Romy had donated the third, which he'd used to carry two deer rifles. Sam examined all three, found a hole in the bag that had held the guns, and tossed it aside. The other two were intact.
All right, he said. Listen close. It should be Mrs. Everett's van that goes out to the box. But we need it over here first.
He pointed to the Odyssey.
You sure about the windows being rolled up, missus? You gotta be sure, because lives are gonna depend on it.
They were rolled up, Linda said. We were using the air conditioner.
Sam looked at Rusty.
You're gonna drive it over here, Doc, but the first thing you do is turn off the factory air. You understand why, right?
To protect the environment inside the cabin.
Some of the bad air will get in when you open the door, sure, but not much if you're quick. There'll be good air inside still, town air. The folks inside can breathe easy all the way to the box. That old van's no good. And not just because the windows are open.
We had to, Nori said, looking at the stolen phone company van. The air conditioning was busted, Grampy said.
A tear rolled slowly out of her left eye and cut through the dirt on her cheek. There was dirt everywhere now, and soot, almost too fine to see, sifting down from the murky sky.
That's fine, honey, Sam told her. The tires ain't worth a tin shit anyway. One look and you know whose used car lot that pup came from.
Guess that means my van if we need another vehicle, Romy said. I'll get it.
But Sam was shaking his head.
It better be Mrs. Shumway's car on account of the tires are smaller and easier to handle. Also, they're brand new. The air inside them will be fresher.
Joe McClatchy broke into a sudden grin.
The air from the tires. Put the air from the tires in the garbage bags. Homemade scuba tanks. Mr. Verdreau, that is genius.
Sloppy Sam grinned himself, showing all six of his remaining teeth.
Can't take the credit, son. Pete Bergeron gets the credit. He told about a couple of men got trapped behind that fire in Bar Harbor, after it went and crowned. They were okay, but the air wasn't fit to breathe, so what they did was bust the cap off a pulp truck tire and took turns breathing right from the stem until the wind cleared the air. Pete said they told him it was nasty tasting, like old dead fish. But it kept him alive.
Will one tire be enough? Julia asked.
Might be, but we dasn't trust the spare if it's one of those little emergency donuts built to get you 20 miles down the highway and no more.
It's not, Julia said. I hate those things. I asked Johnny Carver to get me a new one, and he did.
She looked toward town.
I suppose Johnny's dead now. Carrie, too.
We better take one off the car as well, just to be safe, Barbie said. You've got your jack, right? Julia nodded.
Romy Burpee grinned without much humor. I'll race you back here, Doc. Your van against Julia's hybrid.
I'll drive the Prius over, Piper said. You stay where you are, Romy. You look like shit.
Nice talk from a minister, Romy grumbled.
You ought to be thankful I still feel lively enough to talk some trash.
In truth, Reverend Libby looked far from lively, but Julia handed over her keys anyway. None of them looked ready to go out drinking and juking, and Piper was in better shape than some. Claire McClatchy was as pale as milk.
Okay, Sam said. We got one other little problem, but first...
What? Linda asked. What other problem?
Don't worry about that now. First, let's get our rolling iron over here. When do you want to try it?
Rusty looked at the Mills Congregational Minister. Piper nodded. No time like the present, Rusty said. 3. The remaining townies watched, but not alone. Cox and almost 100 other soldiers had gathered on their side of the dome, looking on with the silent attention of spectators at a tennis match. Rusty and Piper hyperventilated at the dome, loading their lungs with as much oxygen as possible. Then they ran hand in hand toward the vehicles. When they got there, they separated. Piper stumbled to one knee, dropping the Prius keys, and all the watchers groaned. Then she snatched them from the grass and was up again. Rusty was already in the Odyssey van with the motor running as she opened the door of the little green car and flung herself inside.
Hope they remembered to turn off the air conditioning, Sam said.
The vehicles turned in almost perfect tandem, the Prius shadowing the much larger van like a terrier herding a sheep. They drove quickly to the dome, bouncing over the rough road. The exiles scattered before them, Alva carrying Alice Appleton and Linda with a coughing little Jay under each arm. The Prius stopped less than a foot away from the dirty barrier, but Rusty swung the Odyssey around and backed it in.
Your husband's got a good set of balls on him and an even better set of lungs, Sam told Linda matter-of-factly.
It's because he gave up smoking, Linda said, and either did not hear Twitch's strangled snort or affected not to. Good lungs or not, Rusty didn't linger. He slammed the door behind him and hustled to the dome.
Piece of cake, he said,
and began to cough. Is the air inside the van breathable, like Sam said?
Better than what's here.
He laughed distractedly. But he's right about something else. Every time the doors open, a little more good air gets out and a little more bad air gets in. You probably can get out to the box without tire air. But I don't know if you can get back without it.
Ain't gonna be driving, neither one of them, Sam said. I'm gonna drive.
Barbie felt his lips turn up in the first genuine grin to grace his face in days.
Thought you lost your license.
Don't see any cops out here, Sam said.
He turned to Cox.
What about you, Cap? See any local yokels or county mounties?
Not a one, Cox said.
Julia drew Barbie aside.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes.
You know the chances hover somewhere between slim and none, right?
Yes.
How are you at begging, Colonel Barbara?
He flashed back to the gym in Fallujah. Emerson kicking one prisoner's balls so hard they flew up in front of him. Hackermeyer pulling another one up by his hijab and putting a gun to his head. The blood had hit the wall like it always hits the wall. Right back to the time when men fought with clubs.
I don't know, he said. All I know is, it's my turn.
4. Romy, Pete Freeman, and Tony Gay jacked up the Prius and pulled off one of the working tires. It was a small car, and under ordinary circumstances, they might have been able to lift the rear end with their bare hands. Not now. Although the car was parked close to the fans, they had to run back to the dome repeatedly for air before the job was done. In the end, Rose took over for Tony, who was coughing too hard to continue. Finally, though, they had two new tires leaning against the dome.
So far, so good, Sam said. Now for that other little problem. I hope somebody's got an idea, because I sure don't.
They looked at him.
My friend Peter said those guys busted off the valve and breathed direct from the tire. But that ain't gonna work here. I gotta fill up those garbage bags. And that means a bigger hole. You can punch into the tires, but without something to stick in the hole, something like a straw, you're gonna lose more air than you catch. So
What's it gonna be?
He looked around hopefully. Nobody brought a tent, I don't suppose. One of them, what, the hollow aluminum poles?
The girls have a play tent, Linda said, but it's back home in the garage.
Then she remembered that the garage was gone, along with the house it was attached to, and laughed wildly.
How about the barrel of a pen? Joe asked. I've got a Bic.
Not big enough, Barbie said. Rusty, what about the ambulance?
A trach tube?
Rusty asked doubtfully, then answered his own question. No,
still not big enough.
Barbie turned.
Colonel Cox, any ideas?
Cox shook his head reluctantly.
We've probably got 1,000 things over here that would work, but that doesn't help much.
We can't let this stop us, Julia said.
Barbie heard frustration and a raw edge of panic in her voice.
Never mind the bags, we'll take the tires and breathe directly from them.
Sam was already shaking his head. Not good enough, missus, sorry, but it's not. Linda bent close to the dome, took several deep breaths, held the last. Then she went to the back of her Odyssey van, rubbed some of the soot from the back window, and peered in.
The bag's still there, she said. Thank God.
What bag?
Rusty asked, taking her by the shoulders.
The one from Best Buy, with your birthday present in it. November 8th. Or did you forget?
I did, on purpose. Who the hell wants to turn 40? What is it?
I knew if I brought it in the house before I was ready to wrap it, you'd find it.
She looked at the others, her face solemn and as dirty as a street urchin's.
He's a nosy old thing. So I left it in the van. What did you get him, Lenny?
Jackie Weddington asked.
I hope a present for all of us, Linda said.
5. When they were ready, Barbie, Julia, and Sloppy Sam hugged and kissed everybody, even the kids. There was little hope in the faces of the nearly 24 exiles who would remain behind. Barbie tried to tell himself it was just because they were exhausted, and now chronically short of breath, but he knew better. These were goodbye kisses.
Good luck, Colonel Barbara,
Cox said. Barbie gave him a brief nod of acknowledgement, then turned to Rusty. Rusty, who really mattered, because he was under the dome.
Don't give up hope. And don't let them give up hope. If this doesn't work, take care of them as long as you can. And as well as you can.
I hear you. Give it your best shot.
Barbie tilted his head toward Julia.
It's mostly her shot, I think.
And hell, maybe we'll make it back even if it doesn't work.
Sure you will,
Rusty said. He sounded hearty, but what he believed was in his eyes. Barbie slapped him on the shoulder, then joined Sam and Julia at the dome, once more taking deep breaths of the fresh air that came trickling through. To Sam, he said,
Are you sure you really want to do this?
Oh, yeah. I got something to make up for.
What would that be, Sam?
Julia asked.
I'd rather not say.
He smiled a little.
Especially not to the town newspaper lady.
You ready? Barbie asked Julia.
Yes.
She grabbed his hand, gave it one brief hard squeeze.
As much as I can be.
6. Romy and Jackie Weddington stationed themselves at the rear doors of the van. When Barbie shouted, Go! Jackie opened the door gate and Romy threw the 2 Prius tires inside. Barbie and Julia hurled themselves in directly after, and the doors were slammed behind them a split second later. Sam Verdreau, old and booze-rattled but still spry as a cricket, was already behind the Odyssey's wheel and revving the engine. The air inside the van stank of what was now the outside world, an aroma that was charred wood on top and a painty, turpentiny stench beneath. But it was still better than what they had been breathing at the dome, even with dozens of fans blasting.
Won't be better for long, Barbie thought. Not with 3 of us sucking it up.
Julia grabbed the distinctive yellow and black Best Buy sack and turned it over. What fell out was a plastic cylinder with the words Perfect Echo on it, and beneath that, 50 recordable CDs. She began to pick at the sealed cellophane overwrap with no immediate success. Barbie reached for his pocket knife, and his heart sank. The knife wasn't there, of course not. It was now just a hunk of slag under whatever remained of the PD.
Sam, please tell me you have a pocket knife.
Without a word, Sam tossed one back. That was my dad's. I've been carrying it my whole life, and I want it back.
The knife's sides were wood inlay rubbed almost smooth with age, but when he opened it, the single blade was sharp. It would work on the overwrap, and it would make nice, neat punctures in the tires.
"Hurry up!" Sam yelled, and revved the Odyssey's engine harder. "We ain't going till you tell me you got the right thing, and I doubt the engine'll run forever in this air."
Barbie slit the overwrap. Julia stripped it away. When she rotated the plastic cylinder half a turn to the left, it came off the base. The blank CDs that had been meant for Rusty Everett's birthday sat on a black plastic spindle. She dumped the CDs on the floor of the van, then closed her fist around the spindle. Her mouth tightened with effort.
"Let me do that," he said.
But then she snapped it off.
Girls are strong, too, especially when they're scared to death.
Is it hollow? If it isn't, we're back to square one. She held the spindle up to her face. Barbie looked down one end and saw her blue eyes staring back from the other.
"Go, Sam," he said. "We're in business."
"You're sure to work,"
Sam shouted back, dropping the van's transmission into drive.
"You bet,"
Barbie returned, because "how the hell should I know?" would cheer nobody up, including himself. 7. The survivors at the dome watched silently as the van tore down the dirt track that led back to what Norrie Calvert had taken to calling the flashbox. The Odyssey dimmed into the hanging smog, became a phantom, and then disappeared. Rusty and Linda were standing together, each carrying a child.
"What do you think, Rusty?" Linda asked.
He said, "I think we need to hope for the best."
"And prepare for the worst?"
"That too," he said.
8. They were passing the farmhouse when Sam called back.
"We're going into the orchard now. You want to hold on to your jockstraps, kiddies, because I ain't stopping this bitch even if I rip the undercarriage right out in it."
"Go for it," Barbie said, and then a vicious bump tossed him in the air with his arms wrapped around one of the spare tires. Julia was clutching the other one like a shipwreck victim clutching a life ring. Apple trees flashed by. The leaves looked dirty and dispirited. Most of the fruit had fallen to the ground, shaken free by the wind that had sucked through the orchard after the explosion. Another tremendous bump. Barbie and Julia went up and came down together, Julia sprawling across Barbie's lap and still holding onto her tire.
"Where'd you get your license, you old fuck?" Barbie shouted. "Sears and Roebuck?" "Walmart," the old man shouted back. "Everything's cheaper at Wally World."
Then he stopped cackling.
"I see it. I see the blinky-ass whoremaster. Bright purple light. Gonna pull right up beside it. You wait until I stop before you go carving on those tires, lest you want to tear 'em wide open."
A moment later, he stamped on the brake and brought the Odyssey to a scrunching halt that sent Barbie and Julia sliding into the back of the rear seat. "Now I know what a pinball feels like," Barbie thought.
"You drive like a Boston cabbie," Julia said indignantly. "You just make sure you tip."
Sam was stopped by a hard fit of coughing.
20%.
His voice sounded choked.
"Sam?"
Julia asked.
"Are you all right?" "Maybe not,"
he said matter-of-factly.
"I'm bleeding somewhere. Could be throat, but it feels deeper. Believe I might have ruptured a lung."
Then he was coughing again.
"What can we do?" Julia asked.
Sam got the coughing under control.
"Make 'em shut off their fucking jammer so we can get out of here. I got no more smokes."
9.
"This is all me," Julia said. "Just so you know that."
Barbie nodded.
"Yes'm?"
"You're strictly my air boy. If what I try doesn't work, we can change jobs."
"It might help if I knew exactly what you had in mind."
"There's nothing exact about it. All I have is intuition and a little hope."
"Don't be such a pessimist. You've also got 2 tires, 2 garbage bags, and a hollow spindle." She smiled. It lit up her tense, dirty face.
"Duly noted."
Sam was coughing again, doubled over the wheel. He spat something out.
"Dear God and sunny Jesus, don't that taste nasty," he said. "Hurry up."
Barbie punctured his tire with the knife and heard the whoosh of air as soon as he pulled the blade free. Julia slapped the spindle into his hand as efficiently as an OR nurse. Barbie jammed it into the hole, saw the rubber grip it, and then felt a divine rush of air spurt into his sweaty face. He breathed deeply once, unable to help himself. The air was much fresher, much richer than that pushed through the dome by the fans. His brain seemed to wake up, and he came to an immediate decision. Instead of putting a garbage bag over their makeshift nozzle, he tore a large, ragged swatch from one of them.
"What are you doing?" Julia screamed.
There was no time to tell her she wasn't the only one with intuitions. He plugged the spindle with the plastic.
"Trust me. Just go to the box and do what you have to do."
She gave him a final look that seemed to be all eyes, then opened the Odyssey's door gate. She half fell to the ground, picked herself up, stumbled over a hummock, and went to her knees beside the flashbox. Barbie followed her with both tires. He had Sam's knife in his pocket. He fell on his knees and offered Julia the tire with the black spindle sticking out of it. She yanked the plug, breathed in, her cheeks hollowing with the effort, exhaled to one side, then breathed in again. Tears were rolling down her cheeks, cutting clean places there. Barbie was crying, too. It had nothing to do with emotion. It was as if they had been caught out in the world's nastiest acid rain. This was far worse than the air at the dome. Julia sucked in more.
"Good,"
she said, speaking on the exhale and almost whistling the word.
"So good. Not fishy. Dusty."
She breathed in again, then tilted the tire toward him. He shook his head and pushed it back, although his lungs were beginning to pound. He patted his chest, then pointed at her. She took another deep breath, then sucked in one more. Barbie pushed down on top of the tire to help her along. Faintly, in some other world, he could hear Sam coughing and coughing and coughing. "He'll rip himself apart," Barbie thought. He felt as if he might come apart himself if he didn't breathe soon. And when Julia pushed the tire at him a second time, he bent over the makeshift straw and sucked in deeply, trying to draw the dusty, wonderful air all the way to the bottom of his lungs. There wasn't enough. It seemed there could never be enough. And there was a moment when panic, "God, I'm drowning," almost engulfed him. The urge to bolt back to the van, never mind Julia, let Julia take care of herself, was nearly too strong to resist. But he did resist it. He closed his eyes, breathed, and tried to find the cool, calm center that had to be there someplace. Easy. Slow. Easy. He dragged in a third long, steady inhale from the tire, and his pounding heart began to slow a little. He watched Julia lean forward and grip the box on either side. Nothing happened, and this didn't surprise Barbie. She had touched the box when they first came up here, and was now immune to the shock. Then, suddenly, her back arched. She moaned. Barbie tried to offer her the spindle straw, but she ignored it. Blood burst from her nose and began to trickle from the corner of her right eye. Red drops slid down her cheek.
"What's happening?"
Sam called. His voice was muffled, choked. "I don't know," Barbie thought. "I don't know what's happening." But he knew one thing. If she didn't take more air soon, she'd die. He pulled the spindle out of the tire, clamped it between his teeth, and plunged Sam's knife into the second tire. He drove the spindle into the hole and plugged it with the swatch of plastic. Then he waited. 10. This is the time that is no time. She's in a vast, white, roofless room with an alien green sky above. It's, what, the playroom? Yes, the playroom, their playroom. No, she's lying on the floor of the bandstand. She's a woman of a certain age. No, she's a little girl. There is no time. It's 1974 and there's all the time in the world. She needs to breathe from the tire. She doesn't. Something is looking at her, something terrible. But she is terrible to it as well, because she's bigger than she's supposed to be, and she's here. She's not supposed to be here. She's supposed to be in the box. Yet she is still harmless. It knows that, even though it is just a kid. Very young. Barely out of the nursery, in fact. It speaks. "You are make-believe." "No, I'm real. Please, I'm real. We all are." The leatherhead regards her with its eyeless face. It frowns, the corners of its mouth turned down, although it has no mouth, and Julia realizes how lucky she is to have found one of them alone. There are usually more, but they have gone home to dinner, gone home to lunch, gone to bed, gone to school, gone on vacation. Doesn't matter, they're gone. Gone somewhere. If they were here together, they would drive her back. This one could drive her back alone, but she is curious. She? Yes. This one is female, like her. Please, let us go. Please, let us live our little lives. No answer, no answer, no answer. Then, you aren't real. You are what? What does she say? You are toys from the toy shop? No, but it's something like that. Julia has a flicker memory of the ant farm her brother had when they were kids. The recollection comes and goes in less than a second. Ant farm isn't right either, but like toys from the toy shop, it's close. It's in the ballpark, as they say. How can you have lives if you aren't real? We are so real, she cries. And this is the moan Barbie hears. As real as you. Silence. A thing with a shifting leather face in a vast white roofless room that is also somehow the Chester's Mill bandstand. Then, prove it. Give me your hand. I have no hand. I have no body. Bodies aren't real. Bodies are dreams. Then give me your mind. The leatherhead child does not, will not. So Julia takes it. 11. This is the place that is no place. It's cold on the bandstand and she's so scared. Worse, she's humiliated? No, it's much worse than humiliation. If she knew the word abased, she would say, yes, yes, that's it, I'm abased. They took her slacks. And somewhere soldiers are kicking naked people in a gym. This is someone else's shame all mixed up with hers. She's crying. He feels like crying but doesn't. Right now they have to cover this up. The girls have left her now, but her nose is still bleeding. Lila slapped her and promised to cut her nose off if she told, and they all spit on her. And now she is lying here, and she must have cried really hard because she thinks her eye is bleeding as well as her nose, and she can't seem to catch her breath. But she doesn't care how much she bleeds, or from where. She'd rather bleed to death on the bandstand floor than walk home in her stupid baby underpants. She'd gladly bleed to death from 100 places, if it meant she didn't have to see the soldier. After this, Barbie tries not to think of that soldier. But when he does, he thinks, Hackermeyer, the hacker monster. Pull the naked man up by the thing, Hajib. He's wearing on his head because she knows what comes next. It's what always comes next when you're under the dome. She sees that one of the girls has come back. Caleb Evans has come back. She's standing there and looking down at stupid Julia Shumway, who thought she was smart. Stupid little Julia Shumway in her baby panties. Has Kayla come back to take the rest of her clothes and throw them up onto the bandstand roof so she has to walk home naked with her hands over her woofie? Why are people so mean? She closes her eyes against tears, and when she opens them again, Kayla has changed. Now she has no face, just a kind of shifting leather helmet that shows no compassion, no love, not even hate. Only interest. Yes, that. What does it do when I do this? Julia Shumway is worthy of no more. Julia Shumway doesn't matter. Find the least of the least, then look below that, and there she is, a scurrying Shumway bug. She is a naked prisoner bug, too. A prisoner bug in a gymnasium with nothing left but the unraveling hat on his head, and beneath the hat, a final memory of fragrant, freshly baked chups held out in his wife's hands. She is a cat with a burning tail, an ant under a microscope, a fly about to lose its wings to the curious plucking fingers of a third grader on a rainy day, a game for bored children with no bodies and the whole universe at their feet. She is Barbie. She is Sam, dying in Linda Everett's van. She is Ollie, dying in the cinders. She is Alva Drake, mourning her dead son. But mostly, she is a little girl, cowering on the splintery boards of the town common bandstand. A little girl who was punished for her innocent arrogance. A little girl who made the mistake of thinking she was big when she was small.
that she mattered when she didn't, that the world cared when in reality the world is a huge dead locomotive with an engine but no headlight. And with all her heart and mind and soul, she cries out, "Please let us live!"